Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we have lots to talk about. Lots of food and wine. Change in the sunshine, Cindy.
Mm-hmm.
Means good things are coming from the farms in a bit. We have later on in the program with us a particularly brilliant person from Cindy's past, Glenn Roberts from Anson Mills. And I know you're very excited to have him talk with us.
I sure am. He's a brilliant person, as you said, and he has had a lot to do with my pathway and cooking, and also has affected the product that I work with. So I'm very excited for everyone to get to hear his story.
Yeah, Glenn founded Anson Mills in 1998 in Charleston, South Carolina, with the idea of reestablishing, repatriating some of the lost foods from the South in the 18th and 19th centuries. And it's a cool mission. I know a lot of what he has done has been central to what fuels what you do. And I know that he's a guy with some wine background too. So what I want to ask him about is some of those products when they're central in dishes. What does he want to do wine-wise with those things? Because I'm used to working with him, but it'd be interesting to hear another perspective, especially from someone who's originating those products.
Yeah, and there's just so much history behind them. He has been instrumental in preserving these products, and you know they would have just disappeared, I'm sure, if he hadn't. What an amazing accomplishment that is, and profoundly important for our food, our American history, and our food world. So I'm excited to hear him talk about that.
Yeah, so we'll speak with him in the second, and if we're lucky, we can hang on to him a little bit into the third segment. And but in the meantime, Cindy, I wanted to talk to you about pairing. We get so many questions about that. We have so many people that come into places and want to know what's exactly the right thing. I haven't asked you, what is your perspective on, oh, you have to have this particular wine with this dish?
I don't have that. In other words, I don't think that one thing only goes with one thing. I mean, just as you're saying that, that's what I'm thinking. I mean, it's a big world and there's so many choices. And there's a good path and maybe a little wrong path and then a really bad path as far as pairing goes. But right, Tony?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people, I worry about that because I think people, they're trying to get the right answer. They're like, you know what, we're here, we're going to have this remarkable thing, and we have to have this one thing is the thing that works with that. And nothing else will. And
that's not right.
It's not necessarily true. I mean, cooking and food and our reaction to it is dynamic, you know, and wine is the same way. A lot of times I'll try to explain to people, it's a little bit like music and dancing. And no, you're probably not going to country line dance to Tchaikovsky. It's going to look a little weird, you know, with the ballet playing in the background.
Mm-hmm.
But there may be a way to do it nicely. I don't know. And sometimes if you go the exact opposite route, like I'm going to pick my favorite beverage, Dr. Pepper, and I'm going to put it with my favorite dish, which is Cindy's
pork
shrimp
and sauerkraut.
Let's say. Exactly. How's that going to go? I mean,
that's not going to go well at all.
That's a little bit like I have these two are my favorite garments. So if I wear them together, they're going to look great. Not necessarily. So somewhere in between those two things is something interesting. And it's about, I mean, those things, food and wine are dynamic and they have relationships to one another, but also to you and in that moment. And depending upon the sequence in which you have them, you know, that you may want to have, if you've had a meal that's largely seafood and you've had four white wines with prior courses, that may make total sense in a vacuum for those dishes. But if you're having one more dish, it's a little bit of a shame not to have a contrast or an adjustment to a red wine or a rosé or something sparkling. You know, that I think that's what's kind of interesting. It's a little bit, I mean, maybe a brilliant listener will explain how a DJ works and how they do their mix. Because sometimes I feel like that's the way that pairing works for us. And trying to guide people, and it has to be similar enough to transition well, and it's got to be different enough to keep you stimulated.
Right, keep it interesting for sure. Well, and the other thing is, what if you do approach it that, like me, where I love champagne, and you know I want champagne throughout my entire meal. You know, there could also be a category of what people are looking for, or maybe they're like, oh, I want to stay in shadow enough to pop. So then it becomes almost one thing becomes more important than the other, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Or the guest is all about the food and like, oh, you know, I really want to have like game birds and foie gras. And, you know, I want to stick in this category of food sort of. So there's so many different ways to look at it. But in the end, it is that, you know, you guys can always figure it out what goes with what.
Yeah, it's that relationship. And there's no complete rule. I mean, that's the thing that I hope that people can sort of give themselves permission to explore and play. And if you make a quote unquote mistake, well, then you learn something and then it was interesting. And it's also, you know, part of the fun of dining with other people and or interacting with someone who is a pro about the stuff and cares about it is that it's a bit of a group project to, you know, when the goal of the group project is to see how much you can enjoy yourself, that's one of the better things in life, I would say.
Yeah, it's a good goal. Well, and when you have the cellar to deal with, when you think about what goes with what, do you think about it even seasonally? I'm sure you do. You know, like if it's wintertime, yeah, you're not only thinking about the food, but you're also thinking about which is seasonal as well. It's it's question, quite frankly.
It's the entire circumstance, you know, that it's the weather. It's, I mean, that may seem strange, but like it's a cool part of it's the very beginning of what feels like the spring season right now. Mm-hmm. And with that, I'm probably going to think, I really like to drink some things that are the big, heavy Barolo and Barbaresco, things like that, that I will probably begin to say goodbye to for the really warm weather soon. So it's in my brain that, you know what, I'm going to pick, we're only going to get a couple more chilly nights where I'm going to really enjoy that as much as I can. Mm-hmm. So I want to pick my spots for that. And I try to do that, you know, from a guest perspective as well. And it's also, I mean, honestly, some of the choices, you want to surprise yourself. You want to entertain yourself. Mm-hmm. That one of the things that I'll often, it's funny, there are little combinations that are pets of mine to surprise people. One is shellfish dishes because they have strong flavors. They may be traditionally white wine dishes, but oftentimes Rioja, especially something softer, something older, may have an appropriate structure and really interesting flavors and aromas for shellfish dishes. And I think that sometimes is surprising to people. I love Austrian white wines, as you know. Some of the Grüner Veltliner, something as simple as Gravlax or you know, smoked salmon with Grüner Veltliner is really brilliant, especially with all the little salty and fatty garnishes that you like to have with those things.
Yeah, I can just imagine that lifting the dish right up.
Exactly.
That's beautiful.
That citrusy acidity, the white pepper, you know, that sort of, that little bit of like almost like a bitter green tea flavor that can be around the edges of the fruit that's there, especially as those wines age and gain even a little more body and power, they can be impressive. So I guess the playfulness, I think, is important. I think the getting the right answer is not as important as to actually enjoying the process and enjoying the exploration. And it kind of turns on your senses to be doing that, to have a little bit of an adventure with it. Mm-hmm. Just, it's not always going to be successful, and that's okay.
Yeah, and it should be fun. Like you started off saying, I mean, this is entertainment. You know, it like you said, the right and wrong is not important. I mean, obviously we do want it to make sense, but that, like you say, there are no rules. And in the end, being at the table with someone you love, or, you know, your family, your friends, whoever you're with, it's all about, you know, you should just, especially now, you should just be sitting there enjoying yourself, not worrying about anything. And like you say, a little surprise now and then is fun too. You know, it adds to the dining experience. That's, you know, wine is such an amazing thing. And it is amazing how food needs it so badly.
And so, Cindy, I'm thinking, and we love to get listener emails that we can read and respond to on future programs. It's foremanwolf@wipr.org. And my question this week, the leading one I want an answer to, is what is your favorite wine you ever had with a burger?
That's
I'm
fine.
Serious.
Okay.
I'm totally serious.
Yeah, of course.
There was a Vasquez woman I worked with in Washington 30 years ago who was great and worked in very fancy places, and we had a great time working together, but was very unpretentious. And she always said, you know, I just want to open a little place, maybe even a diner, where I can go get a burger and a bottle of Silver Oak, which at that time was a very well-considered, great big California Cabernet Sauvignon.
Wow,
you know?
That's fun.
And that always sticks in my head, that Jean-Marie Garbizou, I think that you met her.
Yes, of course.
But that's, yeah, a burger with a bottle of Silver Oak was always her, like that's awesome. That's the goal. And so I just wonder how many people, because I know what sort of ridiculous things I've done with a burger, because I do love a burger. Mm-hmm. But maybe as specific as we're talking about pairing, and this is a very American sort of pairing situation. If you're putting blue cheese on your burger, does that change? Mm-hmm. You know? Does that mean the ridiculous wine that you want with it is going to be Amarone, perhaps? So please email us, foremanwolf@wipr.org, and give us your ultimate burger pairing. So there, Cindy, as much as you don't love sandwiches.
Oh, it's fine. It's fine. So, Tony, why is wine the thing that's always paired with food? Why not, you know, a great cocktail or beer or, you know, any of the other choices that we have for alcoholic beverages? Why is it always wine?
The simple answer, I mean, it can be really, really good together. The complicated one is that and there are things that do really, really well with beer. I mean, if I'm getting a really good corned beef sandwich, I would like a beer. You could put a fabulous bottle of 1949 Riesling in front of me from Domaine La Romanée Conti, and that sounds great, but I'd rather have the beer, you know.
Right.
You know, that's with sushi, there's wine that I love, in particular, Condrieu. Really good Viognier. It's funny because it's built a little bit like sake is built, where the acidity is low and the viscosity is rich. And actually, I like it much better than sake with sushi, because I like all the exotic aromas at the same time. And there are things that do really well with particular cocktails or particular whiskeys. I can recall being very, very pleased to... I remember when I used to go back and forth to Chicago a good bit on that culinary school board, there was a place I would go to get a really good steak and stand and have a glass of single malt whiskey with my steak. And you know what? At that place and time, that was the thing I was going to enjoy the most with it. No question. So I think that there are other things, but wine, I mean, it is a digestive aid for certain.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, I mean, the relationship, when it's working the way that it should, they grow in their association, and each one kind of sets up the other one to be more interesting, more exciting. You can hear it more clearly. You can see it more clearly. You taste it more clearly in more detail because the one is setting off the other. So, I mean, that's the much longer
that's the answer. Yeah, no, that's good.
Well, excited to say we have Glenn Roberts, one of your heroes, coming up to chat with us, who founded Anson Mills in Charleston, South Carolina, and I know he is part of your story, and then his story diverged, and he's done some really brilliant, important work bringing land-raised crops, you know, to the fore in Southern cooking and getting them, you know, available to the South, right. the country, the world.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have him coming up, and we'll be back shortly on Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, you're not excited about this segment, are you?
I am so excited. I can't wait to talk with Glenn Roberts. He was the general manager of the restaurant where I really started cooking in Charleston, South Carolina, when I was 19 years old. Glenn was a brilliant, brilliant front of the house man and incredibly talented, and had an unusual situation. And I believe the wine cellar was about 90% California, and which in 1985 was pretty unusual. I think that might even be unusual today. But yes, so Glenn is now I buy my grits and polenta and Sea Island white rice peas and all kinds of wonderful things from Glenn, because he is the owner of a mill and has been a part of preserving the pathways of Southern cooking. So welcome, Glenn, and I'm so glad to have you be with us today. How are you?
Doing great. I'm in the middle of nowhere on Martha's Vineyard. Just came out of the field to do this. Hope cell holds up. It's a thrill to be on here with you, Cindy. And Tony, you too.
Well, I'm the person that eats all the stuff that you grow.
Glenn, how did you go from being in the restaurant business to, I remember when you left Silks, you worked on a fishing boat in Shem Creek. Is that not right? And then
that's
you
through the Miss Alva with Captain Junior Magwood, mostly right there around Charleston, going down as far as Beaufort and as far north as I think we made it to Wilmington one time, but that was just a steaming weekend thing. I'm not even sure why I was on the boat, because I think so Junior just wanted to drive around.
What happens from there to getting Anson's? Well, I know you were working at Anson's, which is a wonderful restaurant in Charleston, and then starting the mill. What is that path?
Well, just so you know, when you were at Silks, when you started, the bartender there was my business partner. And although I was standing in as general manager, I was actually under contract for the entire hotel development with my partner, a business partner at the time, Catherine Schaffer now, but Catherine Horton back then. Her husband was working for Serge Clair. There's one out of the history book.
Okay. Yeah,
fantastic,
right.
chef, fantastic French chef who did the classic European stage system coming up from nothing and worked with Ferdinand Plant. So we were surrounded by a bunch of French people, and having a California wine list, as you noted right off the bat, was unheard of in that town. In fact, we had to stand on our head to even get supply because it just wasn't there. Mm-hmm. So the other person that was on staff there, Cindy, a friend of yours, Chip Hughes, Reeves Hughes III, excuse me, from Tennessee. he had worked in San Francisco with Manny Burke and that crowd from Rare Wine, still around, and had come out to work on the wine programs in Winston-Salem when we started our contracting company, because I needed somebody strong on wine. And he came to Silks with us, and if you'll remember, he was kind of a nut, but he's also brilliant, had a photographic palette. And he left Silks and went to Raquel in New York to work with Tom Keller, and then hired me to come in until the whole troops there, which included Colicchio and Anthony Bourdain, on the line, by the way, back then, that they were out of business. They didn't even know it. They'd already blown their entire deal. And it was a terrific restaurant, by the way. Chip was on staff there as a wine guy, and he traded it to work next to Keller because he knew Keller was going to be amazing. So there's a bunch of old guard stuff from way back to starting in Savannah with a group that wanted to bring up architectural landmarks without screwing them up, which was my forte in restaurant and hotel design. They had a building that wasn't out of the Quatre Livres, which the best buildings in Savannah are. Those are the J properties. But They had one that was close. It was a Georgian, so it predated all that. And it became the Pink House. And I actually lived in that property and brought it up from scratch. Nothing. Well, I did work on the Natchez Trail and stuff like that. And Catherine was a partner in all that. And she still is a business partner today. She runs a whole team of marketing people, and she's a partner at Anson Mills. So we did that. And in doing that, that Georgian, I decided to research the owners. And the owners were the Habersham family, and they were rice factors. And they were the first people to work on really hard in vertically integrating Madeira. And they made so much money factoring rice, which is horrific on the enslaved side, and crazy on the we're extracting everything for free labor side, where Mozart actually wrote him a flute concerto. Mozart didn't even like flute, but the money was really good. So that's how the connection for Europe and Madeira and rice worked back in that day. And he took that in order to see sherry coming, Cindy, which I know you remember. Sherry became a rage, and Madeira was falling out of fashion. There wasn't really enough anyhow. So he actually crafted rainwater Madeira in Savannah by optics. He had a cupola with lensed glass at the top of his home, and he had huge magnifying glass, and he'd roll Sertial Madeira in there and train the sunlight through those magnifying glasses on those Jeroboams and Salmanazars. And created rainwater Madeira there. None of this I knew, on top of the fact that the Owens Thomas House was one of the best examples of colonial to federal architecture, and I was just huge into that. I spent hours and hours over there. That was the first place in the United States where they had an over-under cooking system for the cooks, where you could sauté and then finish overhead in an oven that was actually elevated over the flat top. So all those recipes that were in there were look like modern stuff in a production system. So I went from there to falling in love with rice. The Smithsonian asked us to do a special gig. They were going to bring their board of directors on from Tennessee on the train over to Savannah and end with a big dinner, and they chose our place because of the architecture. And then I asked what kind of food they wanted, thinking they wanted the food we were cooking, and they said, no, we want real food. And I said, okay, so I crafted them a menu, and they sent it back in flames and said, do you have any idea what you're doing? And I was freaking out because it was huge money. So they said, you need to talk to John T. Edge. So I called up this guy. I didn't know who he was. And he was very generous, and he told me the same thing. He said, you haven't read anything, have you? I said, well, I'm working in situ here, so I've got the bones of it, and I'm growing rice across the river with a friend. And what more do I need? He said, well, you need to understand the food and where African diaspora fits into that, and understand both the European, African, and, frankly, Asian contributions and Indonesian contributions into that cuisine that you're standing in the middle of that you think you know. And I was just shocked. Yeah. So I started reading, and that changed everything. I ended up burning my suits, blowing up my Lexus, and going across the river and starting for real doing rice, and now it's Hanson Mills.
That's amazing, Glenn. It's quite the story.
Remind me, how did we actually get your products the first time? How did we find out about you?
Hope Cindy doesn't get mad at me. But it's actually a fundamental that goes to the beginning. When we talk about local food, which is supposedly what we do, we tend to use that term with some sort of radius. And in Staples, there was no local, quote-unquote, radius for survival. We went through famine three different times in Connecticut, where the entire system crashed, starting in the 1600s, every 30 years up until 1750. And believe it or not, it continued even up into the 1950s after that. Less frequently, but it still happened, where we had food riots. So the idea of local for Staples has two prongs. And the one that I loved from Cindy that I'll never forget and was really a big impetus for how we work at Anson Mills is the second person, I called up Tom, Keller and said, "Hey, dude, we've got grits. You need to get some of these." And he said, "I don't want grits. Nobody out here is going to eat grits. You got any polenta?" I said, "Oh, Jesus, another season. We got to plant polenta maize." He said, "No, you can use your grits corn." I said, "I don't want to do that, man. If it's going to be Italian, we'll just grow some Italian maize and send it to you." So that was put me off a year. The second person I called was Cindy Wolf. And I was really excited because Catherine and I had talked about that. And we said, you know, Cindy's the best person to talk to because she understands this stuff. You know, she lived it. She grew up in Charleston. So, you know, she'll understand immediately because we were having trouble with locals. They were bored, you know. Mm-hmm. So I call up Cindy and I said, "Cindy, we've got incredible grits. We've got incredible coarse cornmeal. We're doing it all by hand. We're growing the corn ourselves. It's Carolina gourd seed. It's actually the corn that actually determined grits culture for the Charleston North and South communities on the coast, including the Sea Islands, at the outset of settlement here. It's so good. I'm going to send you some." She said, "Great, send it to me. But Glenn, I got to tell you, I've got my own miller. And until he dies, I'm not doing anything." That's a quote.
Oh, my God.
Cindy, you remember that?
No, I don't remember
you probably
that.
Don't.
That shows how loyal I am to my God,
so
Glenn.
Cool. No, it was so cool because that guy was milling on a single mill to order and bringing the stuff to you. You know, and I'm going, "Oh, Miller loyalty." Yeah, and then I looked that up because, you know, the tractor donkey doesn't read. And it goes all the way back to first settlement. Mm-hmm. And it is the definition of local. Your local mill was being able to walk in and walk out in one day. And that was true from Maine and the Maritimes all the way to Florida. All mills were located so a human being could walk in and walk out and provision. They'd bring whole grain in. It was usually three in and two out, which means if you're brought in 150 pounds, you got to take 100 pounds of grits home, grits and meal combined.
There you go. That's awesome.
And if you could get that much, you usually had a kid hauling the last 50 pounds, you had 100 pounds in your back. And or if you were rich, you had a mule. So, Tony, for me to shut up and go back to your simple question, we grow everything in the African sun cycle, which is the oldest farming system in the world. It takes a minimum of 14 phenotypic plant types, species, in order to make that work over 17 years. The sun wobbles. Every 18 years, it goes back to its original place. And in Africa, that was the growing system. They'd watch the sun and plant according to it, and all the plants were spatially because of biodensity and biosecurity, because they had a lot of wild animals that wanted to eat them and what they were growing, right? So they had to have biodensity. So it's a biodensity multiple, not monoculture. As a polyculture, it survived longer than any other farming system in the world. You see it appear in the highlands of China. You see it in Indonesia. And guess what? You see it here. It's called milpa. Only we never documented milpa very, very well. We tend to do that thing with the three sisters. Well, that is true, but it's actually lots and lots and lots of sisters. And any person, I stumbled across the milpa patch on the divide up above Tepanitzawaka in Oaxaca last year, and I counted 40 plus different specific plant types in a thing that measured about 15 by 15 meters as a spiritual plot. They were growing it up on the divide because it's closest to the next level, nine levels of existence kind of stuff. So we grow that way in our systems, polyculture. We abbreviate some, so we only have four plants some places, but we have up to 14 in other places, and we hand select and bring seed up that way. And we're doing vertical polyculture, which means we plant short plants with medium plants, with medium-high plants, with high plants, and the higher plants are fastest, so we take the combine and elevate it and cut high first, then cut next level, next level, next level to harvest. We do that in rice, and we do that in corn, we do it in wheat. And we're all from before 1850, so it's pre-industrial, so it's all what's called land race, meaning hand-to-hand, meaning heirloom, but really selected by hand only over hundreds to thousands of years. All that seed was nearly extinct when we started, and we founded Anson Mills in order to rematriate the entire sun cycle system that was totally obliterated during Jim Crow. the plant types, the foods, everything. It's dozens of plant types and hundreds of foods that you didn't have original ingredients for. So that means that we have Benny, African sesame, that became huge. That means we have sorghums that are African sorghums that pop and also do all kinds. You can pop and make grits out of them. You can roast them and make flour with them and make bannock or flatbreads or African skillet bread with them, like soca, only using sorghum. We have millets. We have tons of different kinds of wheat, barley, einkorn. Barley's the first barley's planted here. We're either out of Egypt or through the Celt system, out of Egypt, through Rome, up into the Celt system, certainly by 1,500 years ago, and we're place-based by 800 to 900 A.D., and by 1100, they actually had a name. It's called bear, and it's the foundation of what we think of as beer in the West. That's bear barley. That was pretty much the first European first contact plant, because it'll grow anywhere and it's salt tolerant. And if you're on the coast, you're going to get salt. So we go from there all the way into understory collards and back again. So we're growing tubers and colewort crops that we don't harvest, that we actually let go to seed just to maintain the seed bed and keep the ground clean. Sorghum, collards, things like that are all neem suppressing in the 14 minimum plant sun cycle system. So your beneficial neems are really good for you. Negative neems aren't, seriously, not good for corn. We've had army wardens take out whole rice fields before in less than 72 hours. We're talking 30 acres. You go and you're at the side and the field's like 5 feet tall. The water is the mirror under that 5 feet. Everything's fine. You go away, come back a week later, and there's no rice there at all. That's what army wardens can do if you don't use sorghum, Benny, and all those other neem management crops.
That's fascinating stuff.
Come out of that.
Mm-hmm. Glenn, we've got to take a little break, and we'll come back in a little bit. Do you mind coming back with us?
Sure. I'll be here.
We'll be back shortly on The Formula Wolf on Food and Wine on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we have with us today Glenn Roberts, who founded Anson Mills in 1998 in Charleston, South Carolina, and who's done so much to really... You've set farming back 250 years, haven't you, Glenn?
A lot of people would say it's more than that, but yes.
So... You were telling some of the remarkable story of all the techniques you guys use to make really sustainable, natural, flavorful product. Can we spend a few minutes on some of the products?
Certainly.
So what is the biggest crop for you all?
Well, we're rice people. That makes us, sounds like a monoculture, but it makes us pursue the rices that were endemic to southern culture along the coast after first contact, because rice, as we know it in the Western Hemisphere today, was not here on first contact. Wild rice was, but it's not Oryza rice. It's not rice, really, even though we call it wild rice.
So tell us about your rice.
Well, I guess the first one, because everybody knows, is Carolina Gold. It is the first long grain in the Western Hemisphere that achieved world recognition as a long grain. It's barely over the line. It's almost medium grain. And it was fighting those cultures that were medium grain, certainly Portuguese, Italian, Spanish, Au Provence, and down in the Camargue, those cultures going over to Persia and the eastern Mediterranean rim around to Africa were more consistently short grain and medium grain rices. Carolina Gold was a long grain rice, and it was brought here by, we don't know. It was first grown by, oh, yes, we don't know. But it's wonderful because it has a grain for grain bounciness to it, and it does this blue, white, clear beginning flavor profile that takes sensory into all new levels. It has hazelnut in it. It has field flavors when it's done fresh out of the field like we do it. And if you partially whiten it, then it has all those amazing mineral and nuttiness things. And partial white means that it just scratched the outer bran layer, the inner bran layer and germs intact. As long as that rice is fresh, it's the highest expression of flavor you can get. But it still looks like white rice when you cook it, and it cooks in the same time as white rice.
But how do you cook it? That's the question.
Well, there's lots of different ways. Cindy and I both were probably raised on the finger knuckle method, which means yes. You put rice in a pot, make sure it's level, put your index finger in there and pour water till you reach your first knuckle and season it. And if you're into Charleston ice cream, as they call it, put lots of butter in there, or you can use oil. but that is the classic technique. You turn on the heat, you bring the heat up. As soon as you start to see approach a boil, you back it down to low cook and put a lid on it, and you slow cook it for exactly fill-in-the-blank minutes, from 12 until 16. People get in fights over this stuff, believe it or not. And then you turn the heat off, leave the pot exactly where it is. Don't touch it. Don't lift the lid. That's why it's called the no-peak method. And when you open the lid, all you have to do is fork it, and it fluffs up, and it starts expressing that, like, beacon blue-white stuff while you're fluffing, and it's amazing. It's an incredible rice.
It is.
And you take it straight to the table, or if you're like me, you just eat it right there.
I'm in love with the Sea Island white rice peas and the Petit Rouge peas. What's the story behind those guys and coming out on the islands?
You should ask. We just got a whole truckload from our seed house down in Mississippi. We have the best. All the land race, all the old plants are doing really, really well with climate change because it's stressing them, and they react positively to stress. Their nutrition comes up. The plants fight more, so they're healthier. They provide better nutrition, and they go to their true type form because white rice peas are supposed to be really small, Cindy, if you and I remember right. When you put them in with rice and cook them with rice, you can't even tell they're there. They're the same size as rice. But you've got all the aroma flavor profile of pilaf, rice and peas, the oldest dish in Western and Asian culture. It's the oldest full food you can get. If you get some greens next to that, you're done.
Exactly.
You know, you've got human nutrition. You will survive, and you'll be healthy. So white rice peas, we have the smallest white rice peas we've ever grown. For whatever reason, the climate's doing this. And the truck is just going to come. It's funny you ask this. It's going to be there when? So it's Tuesday, tomorrow.
Oh, I can't wait to get some
tomorrow,
of those.
And we're going to have white rice peas right out of the field from Mississippi, grew in southern Mississippi. The freeze actually killed them and made them easier to harvest. In this big freeze we had, 3 weeks ago now, 2 weeks? So we're in good shape.
Good.
And we have them. And they're for chefs only. And one might ask, why are they for chefs only? Because we've never been able to get enough of them scaled up to do retail.
Got it.
But you can ask for them. All you do is, like, order Sea Island red peas. And in the note at checkout, just say, hey, Glenn, can I get some Sea Island white peas for these Sea Island red peas? Instead, at the same price. We do that all the time. And that's because chefs like Cindy tell their people that they can do that. So now it's out in the public domain.
I've talked about you once or twice on the radio, Glenn. Once or twice.
Yeah, I've heard that. We get feedback. Small world.
So polenta and grits. There I
you
bet
go.
You people would like to know what the difference is.
Yes, that's a question I get asked all the time.
Okay. And Cindy probably knows as much or more about this than I do, but I'll answer it quickly. Polenta is the Italian word for low and slow. Essentially, it's a concept. Basso, basso, polenta. And if all the Italians Cindy and I have worked for were in here beating us about the head, telling us we did it wrong in the old school, where they're not allowed to do that stuff anymore on the line in the kitchen, thank God. But another topic. So the low, low, and slow. So it applies to any staple. It can apply to I don't know, beans. You can have polenta from, like, chickpeas. In Italian culture, and if you go far enough back, it's the major source of polenta was chestnuts. Go figure. But you're asking the question, which is less weird and more useful in our modern culture. The entire canon of what we know as polenta happened with Italian diaspora, which happened in waves over and over and over again about every half century from first contact forward. And our first rice planters were Italian. So we have this tradition on the sea islands still intact. And they had their own specific corns. And mostly, although Cindy and I both know not all, polentas in Italy are from flint corn. That's really hard. It's the hardest substance that you can grow on earth, right? It's very hard. Like popcorn is flint corn. You can see through it when it's grown right, and I bet you everybody's done that. So that's flint corn. You can make polenta out of popcorn. It makes really good polenta, by the way, if you've got your own home mill. So the difference between polenta and grits is normally polenta is milled smaller, and it's milled from flint corn. Grits are mostly, although not always, because Cindy knows we have Sea Island Flint, too, which was a foundation grits corn on the Sea Islands. That is usually dent corn. So our Carolina gourd seed that we use for our white grits is dent. Softer, hydrates faster, makes a creamier mouthfeel. Polenta, done from 100% hard starch flint, will have what's called palate grip and or slight adhesion in the texture, even though it's super creamy and fun. And the textural differences are all nuanced, but that's our difference. So grits is essentially dent corn in the South, even though it's not 100% true. Polenta in Italy is essentially flint corn, although that's not 100% true. And we tend to honor both of those things because it's important to us.
What's the difference in the milling of the two?
Flint is a pain in the butt to mill. Your mill has to be in good shape because it's very hard. And it also does not want to reduce. And really great grits from my mom's era that she used to get flown out, it was still being done in the 50s. She had her own favorite grist mill outside of Aiken, which is long gone now, burnt. But she used to have a friend who lived in Aiken, South Carolina, who was a Pan Am pilot. And he would bring her fresh rice and fresh grits when I was growing up in San Diego. So we were raised kind of Carolina low country. With fresh stuff, he'd bring collards, he'd bring all that stuff to my mom, tapak, you know, bacon, you name
That's
it.
That's great.
So
wow.
We had all that, and the milling part, the technical part of milling for flint is to keep the heat down because it's so hard. Anytime heat and grains, not good. So we do cold milling at minus 10 to minus 50 with the hardest flints, which are like Sea Island white flint that we do for chefs only. That one we actually do at minus 50 and we run it all by hand. There's no oxygen around because heat develops oxygen. It also changes the amino profile. So the sensory profile from the polenta is going to change. With grits, dense, easy to mill, and doesn't need nearly as much cold, although we do it at minus 10. So we don't have any volatilization because we are packing it instead of cooking it right out of the mill. So dents are easy to mill. Flints are very, very difficult. And if somebody wants polenta demise fino, which is fine polenta, we actually have to be very, very careful with that because you can scorch it. And you just ruin the whole reason of doing it if you do. So those are nuances we don't think about in home mills because we're not milling that much. It's not important. Those are nuances that other people don't have to worry about because maybe they're not using these super hard flints anyhow. And you know, in America, the USDA does not designate polenta as a unique food way. Everything is cornmeal, including grits and polenta.
Glenn, we've got just a few moments left. I've got two questions for you, one serious and one a little silly.
Yeah.
The serious one, important to listeners. How do people find you? How do people find the work that you guys do? How do they find your products?
It's easy. We have a wonderful person named Kay Rentschler, who I happen to know pretty well. Oh, I'm married to her. But she is the creative director of AnsonMills.com and handles everything on the creative side, including, you know, she's a ex, European trained baker, pastry chef, chef. She's been around. She worked for the New York Times and for Cooks and for Gourmet magazine back in the day. And now she works only for Anson Mills, and there's 1,300 pages of documentation and about 350-plus recipes there. It's probably more than that now. And so anything you're interested in, just go to AnsonMills.com, click on it, and you'll find out. If you're in an order, that's where people get our stuff, too. We also have social media, which is Anson Mills Instagram, et cetera, and Twitter.
Great.
We ask listeners to respond via email to questions sometimes. So I'm going to ask you the silly one, so maybe it'll inspire a few people. What's the best wine you ever had with a burger?
Ah!
Jeez.
Wow. Yeah, that's a great
exactly. Exactly, right?
You know what? It's got to be Latosh.
Oh.
Yeah.
Glenn.
And guess who that was? Jay Yeomans, Chip Hughes.
Oh, yeah.
Bill Keener, mm-hmm. Catherine, me. Who else was there? Oh, the daughter of, she probably runs it now. I haven't checked. The daughter of the people that owned the most incredible champagne house in Europe. I shouldn't name her or the house. But she was there, and we were having way too much fun.
Sounds like Chip has good ideas. Hey, Glenn, thanks so much for coming on the program. A lot of fascinating information.
I'm just so happy you came on. It's good, as you said, I'm glad to hear your voice. I appreciate everything you did for me when I first started cooking, and I was blessed to get to work with you. And thank you so much for the products that you make, because it helps to make what I do such a joy. And I'm just so thankful for you. And it's great to hear you today.
Cindy, it's been really impressive what you've done. It's a super pleasure to get this time with you. And I hope we get to do it more on a one-on-one basis after everything's done and said. And Tony, thank you so much, too. It's an honor. You guys take care.
Thank you.
Thanks, Glenn.
Glenn.
Cindy, that was very cool. I'm very glad you thought we should get Glenn on the program.
Oh, me too.
And a reminder to listeners, and I'm glad he was entertained by the question, what is your ultimate, the best wine you ever had with a burger? We'll be interested to hear. ForemanWolf@WIPR.org. Email us or any other sort of question or correspondence that you have for us. ForemanWolf@WIPR.org. And we're out of time, Cindy, so tell people how to follow you on social media.
You can follow me on Instagram as Chef Wolf, and also on Facebook as Chef Cindy Wolf, and Twitter.
My Instagram is The Real Tony Foreman, and you can download this or any one of our other podcasts. Go to the WIPR website, WIPR.org, find the name of our program and click on it, and you'll see a big menu of goodies there. And thank you all so much for listening.
Happy Sunday.